Welcome and thank you to all for forestalling your Halloween festivities to attend tonight's literary event. While I can't promise any tricks, you are definitely in for a treat. Before we begin, I'd like to announce a few upcoming literary events in the Gertrude and Harold S. Vanderbilt Visiting Writers Series. On Tuesday, November 13th, poet Kate Light will be reading at 8 o'clock p.m. in Buttrick 101. And on Thursday, December 6th, Native American literary critic and author David Truer will be reading at 4 o'clock p.m. in Buttrick 202. And I would like to invite you to the reception following tonight's reading. Books will also be available for purchase and signing at this time. Tonight's visiting writer is Robin Lippincott, the author of two previous novels, Mr. Dalloway, published in 1999 by Sarabande Press, and Arcadia, published in 2001 by Viking. His short story collection, The Real True Angel, was released in 1996 by Fleur-de-Lis Press. His work has also appeared in the Paris Review, Fence, the New York Times Book Review, the Literary Review, and many other journals, as well as several anthologies. And he has been awarded fellowships to Yaddo and the McDowell Colony. Not only is he an accomplished and prolific writer, but Robin Lippincott is also a gifted and generous teacher of writing. He teaches in the MFA program at Spalding University and at Harvard University. His recent novel, In the Meantime, spans the lifetime of a friendship among three principal characters, Catherine, Luke, and Starling. This exquisite novel introduces each member of the threesome with an earliest memory and moves toward their first encounter with one another in their small, nondescript neighborhood in the Midwest. The narrative leaps back and forth in time with sections titled Before, After, During, August 6, 1945, Just in Time, and September 7, 2001, chronicling the characters' lives, visiting parallel friendships in Japan and Amsterdam, and concluding in New York City just days before September 11, 2001. Through its focus on chronology, the novel wisely resists the narrative engine that pushes much contemporary fiction forward at such a rapid clip that the landscape blurs past. Here the landscape, or cultural context, is freighted with as much significance as what happens next. Most readers already know what transpired in Japan on August 6, 1945, in Amsterdam, in 1940, and especially on that particular September 11th. Instead of developing artificial constructs of suspense, Lippincott explores friendship as a psychic shelter that harbors and sustains the main characters, nonconformists and free thinkers, in the face of nationalism and homophobia. The author also investigates time by setting sections of the novel in specific and infamous historic moments, imbuing the title with double meaning, by referencing notably Mean Times. Allusions to performers and writers from the heyday of the principal friendship, such as Billie Holiday, James Baldwin, Lillian Hellman, Ella Fitzgerald, and Tennessee Williams, suggest artistic creation as a possible antidote for the relentless and unforgiving nature of time and space, coupled with the hard facts of history. Clearly, a novel as luminous as this bears testimony to the efficacy of art in redefining and reclaiming even the meanest of times. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Robin Lippincott.
I am going to use this because I tend to be sort of soft-spoken. So can everybody hear me okay? Okay. I want to thank the English Department for bringing me here, and also especially Lorraine Lopez for her generosity. The short novel of 170 pages moves through five countries and 70 years, ending just a few days before September 11th, 2001. So it's difficult to fully represent it in a short reading like this. I feel like I would have to read the entire novel, but I promise not to do that tonight. So what I'm going to do is try to represent it by jumping around and selecting parts of it to read. But before I begin, I want to read two of the three epigraphs that set up the book. And these will be important, particularly later in the reading, so I want to ask you to try to keep them in mind. In the meantime, the inviting gesture of dots, dots, dots. Of old, this dodge was the darling of the kinematograph, alias cinematograph, alias moving pictures. You saw the hero doing this or that, and in the meantime, dots, and the action switched to the country. That's from Nabokov's Despair. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. Most of you probably recognize that. So as Lorraine mentioned, the book opens with the earliest memories of the three main characters, and that's where I'll begin. Catherine. An old man with a mask covering his nose and mouth so that only his eyes are visible. She thinks they were green, or was it the mask that was green? That is the thing, or one of the things, about memory. It is faulty and unreliable. It can't be trusted. The mask man takes her out of her mother's arms and walks away with her, carrying her, his own hairy arms extended into a bright white light. She is kicking and screaming, crying, hysterical, her body and face becoming clenched as a red fist in protest. Now her mother is crying too, though less hysterically, but the strange man with the bushy eyebrows and the mask is smiling. She is so young that she cannot yet walk or speak, and of course her fear, if only she could formulate it into thought, never mind words, now it is only a feeling, is that she will never see her mother again, ever. And though her mother is thinking the very same thing, but for a different reason, she, her daughter, does not and cannot know it. Because the strange masked man is taking her away, and her mother is just standing there, allowing him to do so. Separation. A congenital defect of her infant heart had required emergency surgery. She was less than a year old at the time, and her chances, because of her age and size, were 50-50. The year was 1926. But if this is her first memory, and she can't even remember whether it was the surgeon's mask or his eyes that were green, perhaps it was both, can she be believed about the rest of it? Did this actually happen? And if it did happen, does the true color of the surgeon's eyes mask really matter? Luke. His mother's dress, a field of small black and white diamond shapes. She is holding him, and she moves him about on her lap. The diamond shapes become smaller or larger, or eventually a blurry kaleidoscopic fusion of gray, depending upon his distance from them. He delights in putting a single finger, his pointer, into the center of the light diamond and then the dark diamond, the light space and the dark space, over and over, and then looking up at her to make sure that she sees what he is doing, and giggling. She giggles along with him. They are united in delight, but suddenly the black and white diamonds grow increasingly blurry, less and less distinct, a gray field, and then disappear completely. She has put him down and walked away, into another room, out of sight. Now it is cabbages that he sees. No, roses, more shades of gray. A chintz pattern, the sofa. The surface is much softer than his mother, and bouncier, too. He bounces up and down on the verge of hysteria. Then he hears her voice calling to him. It is muted, faint. She calls his name, Luke. He bounces again, and then again, now feeling buoyant, buoyed, elated. She is still there. She has not abandoned him after all. She is calling his name, signifying him, Luke, Luke. And he is laughing and bouncing up and down, so that laughing and bouncing seem to be one and the same. She continues to call his name over and over, and he continues laughing and bouncing, and then her voice, his name, now one, becomes louder and still louder, until it is right upon him, and then suddenly she is there too, and the gray field of her dress becomes distinct black and white diamonds once again, and he is in her lap and can again finger the black space, and then the white space, and he and his mother are reunited, together, one. Starling. There are no people. It is peopleless, blessedly, peacefully, and only much later in his life, ambiguously, peopleless. With only the open window and the breeze blowing the sheer, flimsy, white, see-through drapery in and out of the room, sweeping in and then out again, and so on. And that is all, the extent of it, his memory, the frame of the window, the evanescent blowing in and out drapery, and his own scrawny appendages, arms, hands, legs, feet, occasionally flailing into the periphery of his vision. Whatever he can see out the window, through the drapery, or between its panels, is blurry and abstract. Shapes is all he could say with any degree of certainty. He must be lying on his back in his crib by an open window, and if he could have seen out, he supposes what he would have seen would be a blue sky or a gray or some other shade of sky, pick an appropriate color, depending upon the weather and the time of day, and green grass, or not green, and maybe not even grass, depending upon the time of year. This could have been anywhere between winter and summer. But he does not recall feeling either hot or cold. He would like to say that he saw a dog or a cat or a bird, especially a starling, or even a quotidian squirrel out that window, but in fact he remembers seeing none of those things, no white chickens, no red wheelbarrows glazed with rain. For not only is his memory peopleless, it is also completely devoid of a single living thing, nary a peep nor a leaf, save himself. Save himself. He has been trying to do that very thing ever since. And he too, like so many others who have traveled this path before him, has to wonder if this, his first memory, is revisionist, colored by what followed, that is, his life. He cannot say for sure, and that is the troublesome thing. So now I'm going to jump ahead to when the three characters first meet. They, Catherine, Luke, and Starling, had always known each other, or so it seemed. They first met in 1931 at around the age of 5 and or 6, depending upon which of them you ask and what month it was, on the streets of their hometown, a small, nondescript neighborhood in the Midwest where all three of them lived within a 4-block radius of one another. At that age, their memories were still relatively few and unpacked, but their imaginations were boundless. A wiry girl with strawberry blonde pigtails and the constitution of a team horse, Mary Catherine Flanner sprang from a burgeoning Irish Catholic family of three brothers and one sister, of whom she was the eldest. Another brother and sister would be born in successive years. Lucas Aloysius Aldington, whose wide, friendly, and yes, freckled face was capped with a bowl of wheat blonde hair, had one younger sister, a ghost of an older brother, and a middle name that suggested relatives much further south. And Starling Torrance, with his startling blue eyes, had neither brothers nor sisters, and yet it could not exactly be said that he was an only child, or certainly not a typical only child, for Starling lived with his mother and one of her two sisters and their mother and several cousins and other relations and semi-relations who were always in and out, coming and going, so that one could not easily pin down precisely how many people lived in the house at any one point in time. In the Flanner household, Catherine's mother stayed home with the children but took in sewing for money, always much needed since her husband Colin could never hold down a job for very long due to his heavy drinking. Luke's mother was also a housewife, but she did not at that time have to take on extra work. Things changed for most everyone once the Great Depression fully set in. Bill Aldington was a traveling salesman. And Ermine Torrance did a little bit of everything. Hairdressing, house cleaning, you name it, I'll do it, she'd say, out of necessity, because there was no husband and father, or rather, he wasn't around, ever. Starling had never met him, nor even seen him, though he knew one thing for sure, not only because his mother eventually told him, that was later, but also he had known before that, because Starling was nothing if not always hip, and he knew a thing or two, and it was this, that his father was white. And so there they were, Catherine, Luke, and Starling, in the same neighborhood in that small Midwestern town in the early 1930s, ages 5 and/or 6, each alone yet in and among their disparate families. And then they met and became somehow bigger, an inseparable threesome. It was a meeting that would transform their lives. And yet none of them could have known then, that innocent summer of 1931, they could not even have guessed that something as simple and ordinary as a tow-headed boy pulling an already rusting and creaky red wagon with wobbling wheels down a dusty suburban street and coming upon a pigtailed tomboy in overalls just around the corner from his house and asking if she'd like a ride, and the two of them setting off, trading turns, pulling or sometimes pushing one another, racing and laughing and screaming down summer streets, then stopping to talk and generally revel in the leafy June day and each other. And then before too long, happening what was surely, they both actually said it at the time, surely the prettiest boy either one of them had ever set eyes on in their entire young lives, sitting along the side of the road making mud pies and wearing the most elaborate mud headdress, hardening in the sun even as they exchanged their first awkward monosyllabic words. And then precisely because of his beauty and strangeness, asking if he'd like to join them. And him, because he was feeling lonely, which sadly was nothing new for him, happily and gratefully agreeing. Not a one of the three of them could have possibly known then the profound and lifelong transforming effect that this single chance meeting would have. The dominoes fall. Starling was shorter and skinnier than either Catherine or Luke, so he stood up. And as he did so, his mud headdress, its grains of sand and dirt and clay glinting in the sun, so that it appeared in flashes bejeweled, first cracked, then slid, and finally toppled from his head, though he could still feel the hard crust of it drying against his scalp, eventually splashing into the shallow puddle of water he had made with the garden hose. Luke and Catherine looked at each other and froze. How, they wondered, would this strange and beautiful boy respond to the sudden desecration of the elaborate and appropriate crown he had spent who knew how long making? His beauty, they instinctively knew, would somehow give him the right to be demanding, to be disappointed, or to be downright distraught, the boy diva. In short, to want what he wanted when he wanted it. And they also knew that now, in response to his ruined headdress, he might very well sulk, or cry, or even pitch an all-out fit. Suddenly, it seemed that everything had stopped. All was still and quiet. Such was Starling's power. He looked at Luke, looked at Catherine, and ever so slowly rolled his heavily lashed eyes upwards, and then he held them there. This was nothing if not a performance. He lowered his eyes, looked again at Luke and again at Catherine, all of this seemingly in slow motion. And then at last he threw his head back and started laughing, demonically laughing, those white teeth against the background of what Luke and Catherine must have thought, if they thought about it at all, was really just a healthy summer tan. And so they too, now knowing it was safe, joined in, also began laughing, and the three of them jiggled up and down, belly laughing en masse, as if they were three marionettes on the same family of strings being manipulated from above. And maybe they were. "I was the king of Muddington," Starling cried, beating his chest. "You still are," Luke told him. "You've just lost your crown." Ever efficient, practical, and clear-headed, Catherine was already squatting down onto her haunches and plunging her hands into the mud. Her feet were bare, the chipped and stubbed nails painted a fiery red. "We'll make you another one," she announced, gesturing to Luke that he should join her, because this strange and beautiful boy must have what he wanted. She felt that, and she could feel Luke feeling it too. They simply could not and would not have this unique creature, their new friend, being disappointed. From then on, and unlike most threesomes, there was something completely and wholly equal about their particular three-sided triangle. If Luke and Star agreed about one thing or spent time together on a Thursday afternoon when Katie had to go to the store or run some errands with or for her mother, the next day it might be Luke and Katie who were morally or spiritually or physically together, or Katie and Star. And when all three of them were finally reunited, the two who had been together would make it up to the third who'd been missing by recounting everything, absolutely everything, or at least as much as any narrative can capture, that they had talked about and done in the other's absence. Somehow it just worked that way, averaged out, always. They were like a jazz trio, piano, bass, and drums, with each player having his or her own say, his or her own moment or turn to contribute and shine in the sun, first individually, and then the two and ultimately all three players collectively, blending and meshing and all together becoming one, creating a bigger, better sound. So now I'm moving ahead. The next excerpt takes place roughly 10 years later when Catherine, Luke, and Starling are in high school. And there are a couple of names in this excerpt that you'll need to know. Magnolia is Starling's aunt, and Miss Harper is what they call his grandmother, and they both live with the family. This is just 7 sentences. And now, too, Catherine and Luke were spending more and more time over at Starling's place, passing time, sitting around that warm sun of a kitchen table with Ermine and Magnolia and the cousins when they had to, or preferably fanning the flames of their Manhattan dreams and listening to jazz records, just the three of them, when they could. Not that the two were always mutually exclusive, however, as Ermine, Magnolia, everyone in the house, in fact, except old Ms. Harper, who lay in bed in her darkened back room day and night, her ear to that radio. All of them enjoyed listening to jazz, and they loved dancing, too, just as much as Catherine, Luke, and Starling did, so that sometimes it became nothing less than a full-fledged, flat-down, drag-out, and fun-loving party. Yes, a real party, where Ermine would close the door to Miss Harper's room and get the second-hand Victrola out from the closet, and then begin to spin so many records so fast that a person both could and would get dizzy. And before too long, Magnolia would become Mags, and soon she could be found pushing aside the throw rugs with one foot, and then sooner rather than later they would all jump in, moving furniture and turning down the lights and beginning to feel so high-spirited that they would laugh to beat the band, until the place was as it should be, which is to say, dance-friendly. And then the dancing and the singing and the carrying on would begin, slow to catch on and patchy at first, but then growing over time and swelling as the hour grew later, until things were really jumping, hopping, happening, and swinging, to Louis Armstrong doing his own Sweet George Brown or Dinah, or Billie Holiday singing Miss Brown to You or Your Mother's Son-in-Law or What a Little Moonlight Can Do. But then somebody, usually Ermine or Magnolia, one of them would inevitably slow things down, down to a thick, heavy slowness that felt like so much poured molasses. They'd slow that rhythm down to something such as Bessie Smith dragging that old ball and chain around through one of her blues numbers, moaning, oh, oh, oh. And this was when most of them would pause and take a break and wipe the sweat off their faces and necks and reach for a cold drink, because they were not at this point in their lives, any of them, save for Ermine and Magnolia, particular fans of slow dancing. Though Catherine did nurture a secret longing to slow dance with just the right man, and Starling carefully tended a flame of an illuminated fantasy of him and Luke out there on the dance floor together, holding on to each other and dancing close and slow. But then before too long, somebody would change the record and the tempo by putting on, say, Django Reinhardt and his Hot Club of France as they frenetically sped through I Got Rhythm, or It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing, and the place would start jumping again, literally jumping and jiving, Django's fast-drumming guitar setting the quick pace and getting the heartbeat and the blood pressure humming and thrumming to his and his hot quintet's frantic, rapid, rabid rhythm. A hummingbird playing the guitar with its wings, someone had once described Django. And then usually the cousins and Starling and whatever neighbors there were, because this was something they did all the time, and later Catherine and Luke too, would get up and dance, jitterbugging and foxtrotting and you name it, spinning and throwing and swooping and scooting and swaying, wildly and hectically and also quite often improvisationally, but always full tilt and with abandon, until eventually that particular song would come to an end, and then it would seem, suddenly and for the briefest of moments, yet a moment that had an impact and lasted, suddenly it would seem as if the world itself had also come to a quick end right then and there. And sometimes lately, especially because of the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, sometimes it seemed that it had or soon would come to an end, because now there was no sound and there was no movement after there had been so much of both. And then they would all look at each other, really look at each other's faces and into one another's eyes, until it seemed that some moment of truth was about to occur. But then the next song would begin, and the body would just take over once again, seemingly with a life of its own, and the jumping and the jiving would resume, and at some point, Catherine, Luke, or Star, one or two or all three of them, would make the analogy, would say that dancing was like their summers together, wasn't it, with the rest of the year, the school year, being that time in between songs, when there was no music and no dancing, and the other one or two would nod and say, Amen. And there was a kind of truth in that, too, someone else who'd overheard them would say, because music is of time, and it marks time, through assonance and dissonance and rhythm and repetition and lyrics, however artful or organized or not, there is no metronome in jazz, and so on, free form, free form. And so the years passed. They just swung by. accompanied by and inviolably intertwined with music. And music was nothing but a freight train, a large barge barreling down this track or that river with its incessant and inexorable and indefatigable rhythm, leading our fearless threesome on, pulling them along, body and soul, the sweet umbilical cord of sheer momentum, and then propelling them forward toward the future and eventually hurling all three of them out of their small and respectable, but just not for them, Midwestern hometown, and on their way to... But not yet. No, not yet, because they were still only 16 and 17 years old, and they had a couple of years of high school left. But also, the fierce struggles in Europe and beyond had exploded onto the world stage and into an all-out, white-hot world war. And it was now and for some time to come that seemingly just about everything in their small lives began to break down and fall apart, mirroring the world in precisely that same way. And in the meantime, August 6, 1945, if only my earliest memory, that golden globe of fruit hanging from the ginkgo tree outside my window, whole, full of promise, and seemingly impermeable like the sun or like the world itself, if only it could have held as a true representation of the world. The morning broke clear and warm. I was at the temple, as was my custom at that hour. At around 7:30, there was the usual air raid siren, a minute-long blast, a sound we had grown accustomed to hearing in those days. It blared every morning when an American weather plane flew over and was supposed to indicate only the slightest degree of danger. I noted the sound and looked up into the sky as usual, and then I went on with my daily prayers, just as I had done countless times before. But then at 8:15, the whole world changed, and it changed forever. An American plane dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan. For some time afterward, unable to imagine the truth, people were suggesting that it was gasoline that had been sprinkled from an airplane, or a Molotov Fano Hanakago, a Molotov flower basket, which is a delicate Japanese name for self-scattering cluster bombs. We simply did not know what had hit us. All we knew was the blinding flash we experienced. Some of us saw it as white, others saw it as yellow or golden. One described it as a sheet of sun. And someone else said that it looked as if the sun and earth were melting together. But almost no one who was there in close-up recalls hearing anything at all. Then such clouds of dust arose that I could scarcely see or breathe. And of course there was the ominous giant mushroom-shaped cloud itself, the Kamoko Gumo, like a huge evil head, which hovered over Hiroshima, more or less intact, until the following morning, at which point the shape began to change and amorphize. The day grew suddenly dark. It was like twilight, and the cloudy air gave off a terrible thick smoke. Once we were able to clear our eyes, those of us who were still standing, which is to say, still alive and not seriously wounded, what we saw gradually were the fires, the orange flames licking multitudes of houses, and we saw, too, that so many buildings had collapsed, some with people trapped under them and with just their legs sticking out. Others had been cut in half. So many buildings had been destroyed that those few still standing only accentuated how many had fallen, how horizontal and flattened everything was. Buildings that had been on the banks of the Kyo River were now in the river. The wind suddenly picked up, too, far more fiercely than in a typhoon. I saw people literally pulled apart by it. I remember first noticing that the golden statue of the solid and honorable Buddha had crumbled and been reduced to rubble, and then I saw that the heavy fence at the temple had fallen on several people, most of them young girls who had been taking rest beside it. They were trapped underneath. I could not lift the fence alone, though I tried repeatedly. I called for help, to Tsukete, but no one came. Then one trapped girl, probably sensing her fate, invoked our Emperor Hirohito's name and began singing Kimi ga Yo, the national anthem, and the others soon joined in. Gambar, I heard someone somewhere call out, be brave. And they were brave, all of them, singing Kimi ga Yo over and over. But other than helping them to be strong, affirming their love of country, and distracting them in their time of great pain and distress, their bravery did them little good, as they all died anyway, trapped there, all but one girl who somehow managed to find a crack in the fence and get out. And she is Hara Midori, who became my friend and who lives every day burdened with the knowledge that she survived and her friends did not. Eventually, through the thick clouds of smoke, I began to see all the people, hordes, throngs, a whole horrible sea of people. So many people, 3/4 of the population of Hiroshima was either killed or wounded on that day. People swollen and naked, or in shreds of clothing or bloody underwear. People charred and crawling through the debris like animals. People whose hair stood on end. On some undressed bodies, as so many were, burns from the heat of the bomb blast had made patterns, undershirt straps, suspenders, and the like. Silhouettes of men, women, and children were burned into sidewalks as they walked or fell, and shadows of objects such as ladders and shovels and cranes were imprinted onto the sides of buildings. Some people's eyebrows were burned off and skin hung from their faces and hands. There were children with hollow eye sockets, the fluid from their melted eyes running down their cheeks. And so many people were screaming, running and screaming at the same time, as if the two were somehow connected. Itai, it hurts. Modamida, this is the end. I reached out to take the hand of one old woman to try to help her, to comfort her, but her skin dropped off and she slipped out of my grasp. There were stories of people throwing themselves into the River Ota to cool their burns, and of their skin coming off and floating on the surface of the water. And many people were vomiting uncontrollably now, too, running and vomiting at the same time. I saw several mothers carrying their dead children in their arms or on their backs, unwilling or unable to let go. I saw so much that day. I saw too much. And I think for a while I somehow lost sight of everything, and that I went literally out of my mind. It was all far more than one's brain could hold beyond comprehension. Others describe this as well, a kind of shock, I guess it was, a shock and then a total shutting down of the system, because we saw too much. I saw things that no human being should have ever seen or have to see again. I saw things that I, a poet, a man who loves words, have no words for, things for which I believe there are no words. And I was one of the lucky ones. I was all right. I had many cuts from flying debris and a few abrasions from having been thrown down with the initial blast, but I was not seriously wounded. I was alive. I had survived. And that was one of the strangest things among so many strange things about that day. You would see huge structures completely demolished and made rubble of. And then you would see a paper fan or a scroll or something equally delicate, something made of paper mache, perhaps, that was left whole and intact. One of the most incongruous things I remember seeing was a billboard advertising lion toothpaste suspended in a tree. Then something happened that we could not understand at the time, only afterward, which was true of so much about the event and the day, though there are things that I and many of us will never understand. Very large drops of water began to fall. My immediate response, and the response of so many around me, was to cover our heads with our hands, those of us who still had hands, and run for cover. It was not rain, the scientist later explained, but drops of condensed moisture falling from the volatile column of dust, heat, and fission fragments that had risen high into the sky over Hiroshima. And all the while, those of us who were able to help were trying to do so. I, along with many others, was so very worried when the metallic rumble of a B-52 sounded over our heads. What would happen next? Would there at any moment, and without warning, be another tremendous flash and then the same horrendous after effects? It was possible. We couldn't take any more. We were all terrified. But doing something, simply acting, aiding the wounded, helping where we could, quieted those fears somewhat and helped to free us from our own terror. We carried so many people to the Red Cross Hospital on makeshift stretchers fashioned from bamboo and straw rope. The hospital itself had been damaged by the blast, though not destroyed. There, the staff too, the doctors and nurses, so many of them killed or wounded, but some had survived. And so those who remained worked around the clock for days. It was later said that by nightfall on August 6, 1945, 100,000 people had gone to the Red Cross Hospital for treatment. But it was also there at the hospital that I gradually began to see or to hear about, or worse, not to hear about, people that I knew, people I loved, who had either been killed or badly wounded. My parents were all right, I somehow knew. They lived in Mukihara, 30 miles from the city. But I lost my beloved cousin Yutaka and his parents, my aunt and uncle. Even worse, my older brother Isawa, my parents' only other child, we learned later, had also been killed. His remains were never found or identified. He just disappeared, and so of course we knew. And then later, months later, some unidentified person wrote to us that Isawa had probably been killed instantly because of his proximity to what was determined to be the center of the explosion, which explained why there were no remains. I lost so many relatives that day, along with former classmates, acquaintances, and friends, including my two best friends, Fukai Yukio and Murata Maiko, whom I had known since childhood. We had grown up together, had gone to the same school. What can I possibly say about them? That they lived for 19 and 20 years respectively, that they were good friends, lifelong friends. I knew them for 14 of those years, that they were, both of them, good people, and that they had hopes and dreams and plans just like the rest of us. All of that is true, but it is not enough. Maiko was a nurse at the Red Cross Hospital. She was so proud to be a nurse. Ever since she was a little girl, that had been her aspiration, her dream, her mission even. She had played nurse with Yukio and me all through the years when the three of us were growing up, and then she had worked so very hard to become one, denying herself and sacrificing so much in order to become this person who was trained to help others. Maiko was a very small person, short and thin, and yet her mind was strong and fierce. She could have easily become a doctor and maybe would have in time had she been given that opportunity. But she always had a ready laugh, too. She was not overly serious. It was there, just behind her twinkly, intelligent eyes. How I used to love to make her laugh, especially at the most inappropriate times, such as in class. We shared so much, Maiko and I, all of the things that children share over time. Fun and games, how we both hated the daily calisthenics at school, always performed to lively music. And learning and petty jealousies and silliness and boredom and excitement and maturation. And now all of that is gone because she is gone, though I still have my memories, which are now in some way our memories. Ironically and very sadly, on the day of the bomb, Maiko was not at work. She had just left home, her parents' home, which was situated near the River Ota. She was still living with them. It was 8:10 in the morning, and unusually she was running late. She had been helping her mother clean up after breakfast. She was on her way to the temple, on her way, in fact, to meet me. And she had so many errands to run that day, her mother told me. The only thing we were able to learn is that she was found dead in the middle of the road, somewhere between her home and the temple. Her parents told me that the kimono she was wearing at the time had been burned off by the blast, and that its pattern of flowers, pink peonies against a white background, her mother said, had been imprinted upon her body, which, as I have said, was petite. I want to leave you with her body. Fukai Yukio is another story, another loss, just one of so many, of hundreds of thousands, but one of mine. He was my best friend. Yukio was a soldier stationed at the Chugoku Regional Army Headquarters in the center of Hiroshima. He was tall for a Japanese man, a head taller than I and most, and he had broad shoulders too, like a swimmer, which in fact he was. Yukio had just turned 20 less than a month earlier on July 16th. We had celebrated with Maiko, of course, at a restaurant in a building beside and over the water of the Kyo River. I remember that night so well, Maiko's eyes full of intelligence and glee, and Yukio's laughter. He was so very happy about turning 20, becoming a man. I gave him a paperback about a samurai, a topic about which he always loved reading. And I remember, too, that a full moon was hanging in the sky that evening and also shimmering on the surface of the river reflected from above. Yukio commented on it, the fact that something as solid and real as the moon could appear to be so watery and it's insubstantial. Like my early memory of the ginkgo fruit, I think now, and like the sun, like this world. And Maiko knowingly said that all things were relative. But despite the fact that Yukio was 20 and becoming a man, he was, for the most part, and in so many ways, still a boy. I know because I, too, was still a boy then, and Yukio was my best friend. The bombing of Hiroshima caused me to grow up fast. Yukio was a boy who just happened to be in the army, a very ancient and very sad circumstance that happens all the time. Ironically, that day, the day of the bomb, Yukio was with a squad of soldiers from Chugoku Regional Army Headquarters who were burrowing into a hillside, making one of the many dugouts that were intended to be useful in the case of an invasion. Yukio was among those soldiers who were actually in the hole at the time of the blast, instead of along its periphery. He and the others in the hole should have been safe, but that was not the case. While I was working at the Red Cross Hospital that first day and night trying to help out, amid everything, among the many things I overheard, some of which were untrue, mere rumor, was one doctor telling another that a large number of military casualties from the Chugoku Regional Army Headquarters had been transferred to the military hospital on Ninoshima, a nearby island. Yukio, I remember thinking about him in that moment, where he was, if he was safe. But I was so totally engaged, so caught up in the moment, that I could not think about him for very long, no more than a few seconds, really, and also keep my mind on what I was doing, which was essentially whatever I was being told to do, mostly applying rags immersed in soybean oil to the burns of victims. And so both Yukio and Maiko that day and for a while had to be placed into a far back corner of my mind, where I could only hope that they were safe. Two or three days later, I am no longer sure which, after I had worked myself into exhaustion and then collapsed and slept for more than 15 hours, I was able to think once again about Yukio and Maiko. I learned about Maiko first, simply by visiting her bereft parents, but Yukio had no immediate family in Hiroshima or close by, and so remembering what I had overheard about some military casualties being transferred to the Ninoshima Military Hospital, I went there. Their records, miraculously, were very good and well kept, probably because it was a military hospital and also because it was wartime. Yukio had been admitted on August 6, 1945, bleeding profusely from the neck. A scrap of metal, perhaps a piece of shovel sent flying through the air from the blast, had lodged into and severed his jugular vein. By the time he arrived at the hospital, there was little that could be done other than to try and comfort him as he lay there and bled to death. But there was no one there to comfort him. Everyone was helping someone else. All was chaos. And so I leave you with his long and once strong body. A favorite haiku. In the depths of the flames, I saw how a peony crumbles to pieces. Kato Shusan. Hibakusuka is a Japanese word that means those who have seen hell. And I am one of them, one of the many, though so few of us live to tell of it. I am Sato Seichi, and my body, my very body, not just my mind but my body, buckles and folds under the weight of all of those other bodies, until I feel that I will collapse from the weight and the heaviness and the sadness of all of those bodies, the bodies of my brother Isawa and my cousin Yutaka and his parents, and of course the bodies of my best friends Yukio and Maiko, and of so many other relatives and classmates, and the bodies of those poor schoolgirls trapped under the fence at the Buddhist temple, and so many more, all of the bodies of Hiroshima, and the bodies of Nagasaki, and all of the bodies of Tokyo, and the dead bodies of all of Japan, as well as all of the American bodies, and the German bodies, and on, so many bodies, mountains of bodies, the bodies of war, until I feel that I cannot survive, and yet here I am. I survive. Thank you.
We have a